So with that, it's my privilege to be able to introduce our moderator for today's panel, Judge Jennifer Walker Elrod, of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Judge Elrod is a graduate of Baylor University and Harvard Law School and has served on the Fifth Circuit since 2007 after appointment by fellow Texan President George W. Bush. In our audience this morning, I know we have at least one of your former clerks, another fellow Texan, Corinne Snow. Welcome, Corinne, and perhaps others too out there. So, Judge, thank you for your service to our nation, and thank you for moderating today's discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the gracious introduction, and thank you to all of you for being here today with us. I know that you are anxious to talk about these important areas of intersection between private and public power in the eminent domain context. The materials say that since the founding, the extent to which the public power of eminent domain may be used by or for the benefit of private parties has been a subject of intense debate. I think that Judge Jones put it well yesterday, that was a subject of debate long, long before the founding of our country, maybe in the Justinian period of whether you could take from A to give to B. But time and time, our Supreme Court has considered the cases testing the Fifth Amendment's guarantee that private property shall not be taken for public use without just compensation. 15 years ago, of course, we had the landmark case of Kelo v. New London. We've had a recent dissent from the denial of cert in Eckner versus Chicago. We've had the Cedar Point Nursery case. We've had the Pennies case. This area is hopping. And we have a very distinguished panel to consider this hopping area. We have Mr. Robert J. McNamara, who serves as a senior attorney with the Institute for Justice. He joined the Institute in 2006, and his work has resulted in court victories for property owners fighting eminent domain abuse, tour guides fighting unconstitutional restrictions on their speech, taxi drivers seeking the right to own their own businesses, and many others. Welcome, Bob, to our panel. Next, we have the Honorable Paul D. Clement of Kirkland and Ellis, and he has served as the 43rd Solicitor General of the United States from June 2005 until June 2008. He has argued over 100 cases before the United States Supreme Court, including McConnell v. FEC, Tennessee versus Lane, United States versus Booker, Epic Systems Corp. versus Lewis, and the list goes on and on. We were both in Section 3 in Harvard Law School in our class together, so he was the really smart one. Professor Roderick Hills is the William T. Comfort III Professor of Law at NYU School of Law. He teaches and writes in a variety of public law areas, constitutional laws with an emphasis on doctrines governing federalism, local government law, land use regulation, jurisdiction, and conflicts of law, as well as education law. His interest focuses on a common focus on the problems and promise of decentralization. The United States, in his view, has one of the most decentralized systems of regulation in the world, placing enormous power over land, schools, assistance to the needy, and many other topics under the control of subnational governments, ranging from school districts to states. We look forward to hearing from Professor Hills and his work involving decentralized legal regimes with an eye towards how to balance these costs and benefits. Thank you, Professor Hills, for being with us today. And last but certainly not least, we have Mr. Joshua Thompson, Director of Legal Operations for the Pacific Legal Foundation. Joshua Thompson joined PLF as an attorney in 2007, and his litigation practice has covered all PLF subject areas with a particular focus on equality and opportunity. Joshua argued PLF's 13th case before the United States Supreme Court Cedar Point Nursery versus Hasid, where the court ruled that a California regulation that allowed union organizers onto private property violated the Fifth Amendment's taking clause. We look forward to hearing you discussing this case and others, Joshua. Thank you for being with us today. It's my understanding that Bob is going to take the first crack at this very interesting subject matter. Sure. You know, when I was a lawyer, I used to represent the electric company in my town, and sometimes we had takings powers, but sometimes we would be the person who was the entity that was taking from, because the toll roads would want to come in and take our easements and our land. We would have to negotiate all that. So I know that this is a very complicated and interesting subject matter. So please lead us off and teach us what you know.
Well, thank you very much, Your Honor. It is a complicated and interesting subject matter. And thanks to all of you for coming to the property rights panel here in the basement, which is where property rights frequently find themselves. And so I thought a useful way to frame today's discussion is to very briefly just talk about government power itself and of the different types of government power. I think it's very common when we talk about federal power to talk about the different powers the government might be exercising, right? Congress may be using the commerce power or the taxing power, but an original understanding of government power actually commonly talked about government power that way, that government as a whole was made up of a bundle of discrete powers, particularly as relevant here, the police power, which was the government's power to regulate behavior to protect the general public health and safety, and the eminent domain power, which was the government's power to take private property for a public use. And that's a distinction that has in many ways fallen out of modern law. When we're talking about government power, and especially state and local government power, we tend to just say the government has the police power. And the police power is the government's general power to do stuff. And should the government decide to do stuff to you, then, you know, God have mercy on your soul. And I think that's incorrect. And I think that's incorrect in a way that illuminates a lot of the modern controversies we're having, both because sometimes the police power can be used in ways that really are an exercise of the eminent domain power. And sometimes the eminent domain power's historical limits are ignored because it's being treated as if it's just the police power. And I think it makes a certain amount of intuitive sense that there's a difference between the government's ability to regulate behavior and the government's ability to take away our stuff. A rule that says I'm not allowed to throw my water bottle at Josh is a reasonable rule that has to do with the general sort of decorum of the panel. A rule that says I'm not allowed to have my water bottle at all because, you know, someone else is thirstier than I am is perhaps a different sort of rule, a different sort of power that we might want to put different limits on. And we see this distinction come up in a lot of areas, whether it's overreaching exercises of the police power, where the government may say, if you want to be in the business of selling raisins, you have to give us some of your raisins for free. Or the government might say, if you want to be in the business of publishing books, you have to give us some of your books for free, which is also a thing the government does. Or the government might say, if you want to be in the business of growing crops, you have to give us an easement over your farmland, which we will hear more about later. But at the same time, there are actual avowed exercises of the eminent domain power that are all too often treated as if they're purely exercises of the police power, which brings us to what remains, for my money, the largest controversy in eminent domain and property law today, which is the continuing viability of the Supreme Court's decision in Kelo v. City of New London. And fundamentally, the error that the Kelo decision made, and I think Justice Stevens has subsequently admitted to this, is that in its attempt to trace the historical roots of the eminent domain power, the Kelo majority is relying on 19th century cases that aren't about the eminent domain power, that are about the police power. And the limitation of eminent domain for public use was there for a reason, because the eminent domain power, the power to completely divest someone of their property, is in fact a more troublesome power. It needs to be more thoroughly cabined. And I think what we've seen in the wake of Kelo is that there is a broad recognition that this is true. Some of this has come from the court itself. As Judge Elrod noted, there was a dissental last term, a three-justice dissental in Eikener, calling for the court to affirmatively rethink Kelo. But some of it is actually what you see in state high courts. State Supreme Court after state Supreme Court has rejected the Kelo holding, most recently the Iowa Supreme Court. And I think what's most striking about the Iowa opinion is you frequently see state court opinions that say, well, our history is different from the federal history, and so we're adopting a different view of our state constitution. And what the Iowa court really says is just, Kelo's wrong. On the logic of Kelo, you could take any Motel 6 and replace it with a Hilton, and we're not going to allow that to happen in this state, because that means the public use clause means nothing. And I can't think of another opinion that has been so routinely and directly rejected by state courts simply on the grounds of its own internal logic, which I think means that there's a real prospect for a reconsideration of Kelo at the federal level. But the other thing that is a growing issue in eminent domain law is the use of eminent domain as a stand-in for the police power, as evidenced by a case IJ is litigating right now on Long Island, where a small family business wanted to open a hardware store and faced the kind of barriers that small family businesses frequently face. The city wouldn't give them a permit. The city wouldn't give them the zoning permissions they needed. And the family fought through all of this. They wanted to build their hardware store. They owned their land. And finally, they filed a lawsuit in state court saying that the city was required to give them their permit. And as soon as they prevailed in a motion to dismiss in that lawsuit, the city announced that actually what they really wanted on that spot was a park. And they were going to use eminent domain to build what they call a passive park. A passive park is a vacant lot. And there have been a number of state high courts that said, no, this is a pretextual use of eminent domain. It's not a public use simply to destroy something, simply to take away something you don't want. A public use is actually something you want to do, to use for the public, which is an issue that is underdeveloped in kind of federal constitutional law, but I think goes, as a lot of the rest of this discussion is going to go to this division between the eminent domain power, which is for the public use, and the police power, which is regulation for the general public health and safety. I think that dichotomy has fallen out of a lot of our modern discussions, and I think the absence of that dichotomy is why we so frequently see regulators and government officials running up against what the courts are actually going to allow under the Constitution. I have promised to keep this short because I think the most interesting part of these panels are always the discussion and the Q&A, so I will leave it there, and I very much look forward to hearing from my co-panelists.
Thank you, Robert. I think that leads well into my discussion. I want to just first thank the Federalist Society for having me here today. I have a long history with the Federalist Society, and I think it ties in well to what Robert was talking about. My first legal job ever was a clerk, a 1L clerk at the Federalist Society, and I think it was the first legal clerk that they ever had. So I got there, and Peter Redpath really didn't know what to do with me. So he had me summarize Supreme Court opinions for that first year, and that was the year that Kelo came out. So I actually summarized it, and it was probably nonsensical, but that was my first legal job. But I'm here to talk about Cedar Point Nursery, PLF's 13th Supreme Court victory. My first case that I argued before the Supreme Court, which I think makes me the most distinguished lawyer from Wisconsin ever, is that right?
One or two, I don't know, somewhere there, yeah.
So Cedar Point Nursery involved a California regulation that allowed union activists to come onto private property for 3 hours a day, 120 days out of the year. And we challenged this as a physical taking under the Fifth Amendment. But to understand exactly what this regulation allowed, I do have a 15-second clip that I hope is ready to run that demonstrates what the access regulations allowed at on our client's property, Cedar Point Nursery. No one had it. Okay. Well, anyway, you can visit that video on PLF's website, Pacific Legal Foundation. Essentially, what happened is our clients had their Northern California nursery, had no idea of this, that this regulation existed. Most of the union activity in California is in the Central Valley. But one cold October morning in their 6-week window to harvest, the union stormed onto their property at 5 in the morning with bullhorns screaming down the line, and they didn't know what the hell was going on. They woke up our client who was sleeping at the time, and he said, well, call the police, get the police out there. So the police come out and they said, I'm sorry, we can't kick them off. If we kick them off, we would have to arrest you because they are legally allowed to come onto your property. So we challenged this regulation as a taking under the Fifth Amendment. We argued in our complaint and framed the issue as this is akin to taking an easement. And of course, if a government takes an easement, it would be routine requiring compensation. The government defended on the grounds that maybe it's an easement, maybe it's not an easement, but it's limited in time. Easements to be require compensation require 24/7 access. This only requires access or only permits access 3 hours a day, 120 days out of the year, so therefore it can't be a per se taking. It's merely a regulation on use and therefore should be governed under Penn Central's multi-factor analysis. And that issue won the day at the district court, won the day at the Ninth Circuit. We went en banc, we got an eight-judge dissent, but it was a dissent, and we had to petition the Supreme Court. We did frame the issue, again, as an easement being taken from our clients, and again, the government said, it's fine, it's an easement, but it's only, it's not a 24/7 easement. The Supreme Court grants cert, but now with the light of the Supreme Court looking at this case, it's clear that, well, this isn't exactly an easement, right? It's not transferable, it's not alienable, it's not recorded on your property. And so now, for the first time, California is really leaning into the idea that, it's not an easement. If it were an easement, we'd have to pay, but it's not an easement, so we don't have to pay. But fortunately for us, there's this history of Supreme Court precedent from Cosby and Portsmouth Harbor that uses language like servitudes and easements, that these aren't easements as we understand easements, recordable, alienable, transferable, but they do deny the right to exclude in a meaningful way. They allow entry onto private property. And so we, I think, really leaned into that language of denying the right to exclude. And the Supreme Court, of course, in a 6-3 opinion, ruled in our favor that that this was a Fifth Amendment per se taking, and we were entitled to compensation. Of course, we didn't seek compensation, but we got an injunction. I think it's the Cedar Point Nursery did two things to clear up property law. I think the first is that there was this understanding from Lingle that was sort of in tension with Tahoe Sierra of whether physical takings, physical invasions, were a subset of regulatory takings. Lingle said, yes, it's a subset. Tahoe Sierra says, no, they sort of stand outside of the regulatory taking framework, and they are more akin to eminent domain because this is the government actually taking access to your property, denying you the right to exclude. And I think Cedar Point Nursery pretty much sides with Tahoe Sierra, which is what we had argued strategically because the Chief Justice had argued that case. And the second thing that I think that Cedar Point clears up is Loretto. Loretto is the cable box in New York. The government really relied on Loretto. We both relied on Loretto. They had argued Loretto demonstrates that it has to be permanent, continuous on your property. That didn't really bother us because we could say this regulation is always on their property. No matter what day of the year, this regulation is infringing on their property rights. It may not be that access is being taken at that moment, but the regulation exists. But nevertheless, we did want to emphasize more so that it was the right to exclude that was being denied and that it didn't matter if the right to exclude was limited in time. After all, the Nolan court had held that there aren't people going to and fro in front of the Nolan's beach. Nobody's stationed in front of their property 24/7. It's the right of access that's being denied, and that right merits compensation. The Supreme Court ruled in our favor. I think the holding of Cedar Point Nursery isn't obvious. I think the best formulation of it is that any denial of the right to exclude merits compensation. Pretty easy. But baked within the right to exclude is four exceptions. And I think these four exceptions are what are going to mark most of the litigation of Cedar Point going forward. Now, I think there are some things that are clear. If the government wants to take a daylight easement across your beachfront property, that would violate Cedar Point. We had a case, Nick versus Township of Scott, where the government had allowed the public to come on to search for Revolutionary War gravestones. I think that clearly violates Cedar Point. But the four exceptions to the right to exclude recognized by Cedar Point are first, open to the general public. This is Pruneyard. This is why we actually got into this case. We were looking for a case to overrule Pruneyard, but the case went in a different direction. But that Pruneyard remains good law. If the business opens itself to the general public, It is voluntarily giving up the right to exclude. So any government regulation that denies the right to exclude it's not denying the right to exclude because you've already given it up. The second exception are torts, so mere trespasses. Imagine if a government utility company comes to service the telephone pole and they accidentally park on your, or maybe purposefully park on your lawn. That's not a taking. That's not denying you the right to exclude. At most, it's a tort. Maybe it's a non-compensable tort, but it's not denying you your property right. There will be litigation over repeated trespasses when they rise to the level of a taking and when it's just mere trespasses, but that will bear itself off in future litigation. The third exception is to background principles of property law. You hold your property subject to certain background principles. One of those principles is that you are allowed to, if the government comes onto your property with a valid warrant, you cannot kick them out. So that's not a taking of your property right when the government searches your property. It is inherent in your property right that if they have a valid warrant that they can come on there. Now maybe you have a valid Fourth Amendment claim, but it's not taking your property right. And the final exception is conditions. The government can condition your right to exclude in exchange for a government benefit. So if you want to open a pharmaceutical company, this is according to the case law, is at least a dangerous chemical that you don't have the right to trade in commerce without a government benefit. They can create inspection regimes for your pharmaceutical company, denying you the right to exclude in exchange for the benefit of being able to trade pharmaceuticals in commerce. So I think those four exceptions will be where Cedar Point goes forward. I do want to say one last bit. When I was getting on the plane to come here, As a public interest lawyer, we owe all of our work to our great clients. We spend a lot of time finding our clients. And I got the unfortunate news that the owner of Cedar Point Nursery passed away on Sunday. So, thank you.
Does this work? Oh, great. It's great to be here, and one of the reasons it's great to be here is there are great lawyers who come here. We law professors don't get to mix with lawyers as much as I like. Josh is a great lawyer, and you know, so he can tell you how these cases come to be in a way that a law professor who's not litigating them really can't. So, Josh, that's great. And great lawyers care about their clients, too, in a way that law professors don't because they don't have clients. I'm always cast at these FedSoc events as the guy who disagrees. I'm the official debate guy. And so I'm going to be disagreeable. And my big disagreement is going to be whether federal constitutional takings will ever be a growth industry. My claim is it probably never will be. Why? Well, because constitutional takings litigation is sort of like a land war in Asia. It's a quagmire. Right? We got 1,000 federal district judges, and they've got to supervise literally hundreds of thousands of complex, fact-intensive decisions about rent control, subdivisions, zoning and conditional use permits. No way that tiny little force of commandos is going to be able to hold that terrain. And so whenever the Supreme Court gets involved in takings, here's what happens. They announce a brilliant new rule in the 80s, like Lucas, and then they slowly retreat with the denominator. Right? They announce a brilliant new rule like Loretto. You can't permanently physically occupy, and it turns out there's a ton of conditions that means the federal courts back off. So what I want to talk about today is why I think Loretto and Cedar Point's nursery doesn't have very many legs. And I want to talk about that fourth condition that Josh just mentioned, that conditions on a governmental benefit. And I want to use the case study of rent control to explain why Loretto / Cedar Point's nursery will probably not be a great vehicle for undermining rent control. Now, the reason why this is timely is there are literally 5 cases pending in federal district court trying to apply Cedar Point's nursery Loretto to New York's new 2019 rent control regulations. And boy, there's never been a better time to do this because New York State's 2019 rent control regulations are absolutely crazy. So if you're going to strike down rent control, this is a great time to do it, and we've got a great precedent from Josh to do it with. Why? Well, rent control seems to give a third party permanent physical occupation of somebody else's land. And New York has just made it even more permanent. So what I want to talk about quickly is how these rent control regulations work, why they seem to violate Cedar Point and Yee versus City of Escondido, which is the 1992 case that governs this area, and why these cases are totally failing. Then I'm going to end with a few hints as to why you might make them a little more successful if you made them narrower. But just keep in mind, land war in Asia. Unlikely that a federal court will want to get too deep into this area. So what do the new rent control regulations do? They essentially make it very difficult to decontrol units. Typically, rent control is limited by the fact that a landlord can remove his unit from the rent-controlled market through a condo conversion. Basically, what happens is they say, great, we're not going to rent anymore. We're going to get out of the rental business. And what New York has said is that's going to be very difficult through rules like getting rid of what's called luxury decontrol, very severe limits on a landlord reoccupying a unit for personal use. So if you actually want to say, I want to live there, you can only do it for a year and you have to show necessity. And a new rule on condo conversion that makes it very hard to convert a 6-unit building to condos. You need 51% of the tenants to agree. And as my land use lawyer friends say, good luck with that. So it looks like this is a permanent physical occupation. If you're a landlord, you're going to have to stay in the landlord business no matter what. If your tenant dies, you can't convert it to a condo unless everybody else in the building pretty much agrees. Seems to violate permanent physical occupation of Cedar Points, and in particular, it seems to allow you to get around Yee versus City of Escondido. This is a 1992 case in which the Supreme Court upheld a California rent control rule on mobile home pads. But they said, the reason why we're upholding this is it's a facial challenge, and you haven't shown that the landlord must, quote, refrain in perpetuity from terminating a tenancy. Well, now it looks like you can show that it's impossible to terminate a tenancy. If you're in the rent control business and a building that was built before 1974, that's where rent stabilization governs in New York, pre-1974 buildings. No way you can get rid of tenants. If the tenant dies, you've got to find a new one. Or you could just leave the place vacant, in which case you're violating Lucas, no economic benefit, right? So this looks like a great possibility for a challenge. And guess what? The Supreme Court even dropped a hint in that eviction moratorium case from the CDC. This is what the Supreme Court said. Many landlords have modest means, and preventing them from evicting tenants who breach their leases intrudes on one of the most fundamental elements of property ownership, the right to exclude, citing Loretto. So doesn't this look like the Supreme Court's basically begging litigators to challenge rent control? However, there are 5 cases that have been brought in New York Federal Court, Eastern District of New York, and every one of them have lost at the district level. They're before the Second Circuit now, but I predict they'll lose there too. Why? Facial challenge. A facial challenge to rent control will never succeed because it essentially means the court's going to have to take a position on price controls. And price controls include minimum wage laws, utility regulations, a variety of rules where the court just doesn't want to get involved. They might think they're inefficient. They're right. They might think they're dumb. They're right. But that doesn't mean the Supreme Court wants to be the supreme czar of the economy. So unless you have an exit strategy where you can say, look, you don't have to get rid of all price control. Indeed, you don't have to get rid of all rent control. There's no way that the Second Circuit will want to stick its foot in this cow pie. Now, I told you, and I want to explain why that might make sense. I want to defend that. That position is defensible on the grounds that the place you should be bringing these cases is in state court under state constitutions. And you might say, why? If feds can't do it, why can't the states do a better job? There's more of them. State Supreme Courts are elected. They feel they have a greater popular mandate to get involved in complex policy. There are literally hundreds of state court judges for every federal court judge. They can get involved in land use policy. They can review these things through mandamus procedures or certiorari procedures. And third, state constitutions are easy to amend. And so if they get it wrong, the people can come in and correct them. And so it's really a much better idea, I think, to focus on developing state constitutional law state by state rather than trying to go to the feds and say, try to police this myriad of economic regulations. However, I promised you I would suggest a strategy that a lawyer, a smart lawyer, who knows how to develop a case, might bring in federal court. as applied, find a specific plaintiff and try to find a plaintiff who's being barred from reoccupying their own unit. I suggest, say, I don't know, a Hasidic landlord in Williamsburg who wants to bring his family into a six-unit building, right? And sorry, you can't reoccupy the unit. That kind of as-applied case highlights a case where somebody has been perpetually barred from exercising their right to exclude. That sort of case might win, but that means you have to wait a long time for the right plaintiff. I think one of the reasons why Cato and a lot of these great litigation houses jump in with facial challenges is they want to get started right away. But that means they have a dog of a case, because it means they're inviting the court to participate in a land war in Asia without an exit strategy, and we know from what this summer where that leads you. Okay, that's all.
So delighted to be with the judge and with my fellow panelists. I think the reason that I'm here talking about property rights and not upstairs talking about the Second Amendment is because one of the cases that I argued recently in the Supreme Court was a case called Penn East. And the issue in Penn East was the circumstances in which when the federal government delegates its eminent domain authority to a private entity, whether the private entity can then exercise that eminent domain authority vis-a-vis state property. And the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote with a relatively interesting lineup of justices, said that there wasn't an 11th Amendment problem with that lawsuit, and so the answer is yes. The federal government can delegate its eminent domain authority to a private entity, and then that private entity can exercise the eminent domain authority, much the way that the judge was talking about her client back in the day, as a utility exercising the eminent domain authority, and they can do that against all forms of property owners, effectively, including state property owners. So most of the debate in the case, frankly, is about federalism and 11th Amendment issues, and if there are questions about that, happy to talk about that in the Q&A. But since this is really more of a property rights panel than a federalism panel, I think I'll skip to what I think are the interesting implications from that. And, you know, like most litigators, I want to make 3 points. The first point, and really the most central point, is I think in thinking about the question of whether it's okay for the government to delegate its eminent domain power to a third party, a private party, I think it's very important to think about that issue separately from the Kelo question and whether the condemnation is for a public use or a public purpose, depending on whether you're reading text or Supreme Court cases. But those are really two fundamentally different issues, and they always have been different issues. And so to prove that they're not just different, but they've always been different, I've brought Professor Cooley's treatise on constitutional limits from 1868. This is a favorite treatise of Justice Scalia and others because it gives you a pretty good snapshot of the way that courts were thinking about a lot of constitutional issues right around the time of the adoption of the Reconstruction Amendment, so contemporaneously with the ratification of the 14th Amendment. And so it's in the public domain, so you can get it online. And I don't get any royalties, but I would invite everybody to pick up a copy of Cooley's treatise because it's one of the best things written since the Federalist Papers. There's kind of 3 quick passages I'm going to read. The first does 2 things, it captures the idea that the public use question, the Kelo question, has always been a hard one. And there's always been an understanding, though, that there are limits, judicially enforceable limits, on taking property from one person and giving it to another, not for a public use. And the other thing it does, at least for me, is, you know, there's a tendency when you come across a bad idea, at least a bad idea in my view, like somebody can take my property and give it to another simply because in my possession, the government has deemed the property blighted. That seems like a dangerous notion, and a lot of times when you come across a dangerous notion in an opinion written by the Supreme Court in, say, the 1960s, you tend to associate it as being like a new bad idea. And this passage shows that that idea was actually kind of live and a bad idea in 1868 as well. So in describing this, Cooley says, and I'll quote, talking about the various kind of arguments you can make for public benefit takings, it may be for the public benefit that all the wild lands in the state be improved and cultivated, all the lowlands drained, all the unsightly places beautified, all dilapidated buildings replaced by new. Because all these things tend to give an aspect of beauty, thrift, and comfort to the country, and thereby to invite settlement, increase the value of lands, and gratify the public taste. But the common law has never sanctioned an appropriation of property based on these considerations alone, and any such appropriation must therefore be held to be forbidden by our constitutions, plural, state and federal. Back in 1868, the idea of, you know, just taking somebody's property, not for a public use, but just because, you know what? I, as the government, think it's more valuable in the hands of another person than the one who currently owns it, has never been accepted as something that's routine or unproblematic and certainly subject to constitutional limits. Now, at the same time, like three pages later in his treatise, Cooley separately addresses the question of whether the eminent domain power can be delegated. And here, he thinks, there's not much of an issue. He says, it has long been settled that it is not essential that the taking should be to or by the state itself, if by any other agency, in the opinion of the legislature, the use can be made equally effectual for the public benefit. And then he follows up on that a page later and says, if the legislature, reflecting the public sentiment, decides that the general benefit is better promoted by the construction of infrastructure through individuals or corporations, it would clearly be pressing a constitutional maxim to an absurd extreme if it were to be held that the public necessity should only be provided for in a way which is least consistent with the public interest, i.e., only by the state itself. So what, right back in 1868, there's this clear distinction. Another great treatise I would highly recommend and is also in the public domain is a treatise on eminent domain law written by John Lewis in 1888. This is like the Bible for eminent domain law in sort of the 19th century, and it goes into detail on like all sorts of issues that, you know, that probably Josh and Bob have thought through, but most people, even if they thought deeply about eminent domain power, haven't thought about, like, you know, how the courts administer it, whether there was a right to a jury, what do you do if you have an eminent domain taking and then the entity that took it goes bankrupt or, you know, decides to get into a different business? How do you reclaim property that's been taken? He goes through all of this by surveying the cases in 1888 that had been decided up to that point under the state constitutions. And he says whether the taking is done by the state itself or the power is delegated to a third party, a corporation typically formed for the purpose, is an immaterial consideration. And the third and best source for the idea that these two things are different is Justice Thomas's Kelo dissent. Because in that dissent, he has to wrestle with the idea that there is a long history of delegating authority to, first, the Mill Acts are like the sort of granddaddy of all of this, and then there are turnpikes, and then there are railroads, and a lot of the takings law in this country was developed in the context of those infrastructure projects. And the most of them, frankly, were infrastructure projects that were administered by private corporations, often created just for that purpose, and they were the ones exercising the eminent domain authority. So my basic point is, I think if you are skeptical about the majority opinion in Kelo, I wouldn't have that skepticism translate over to the idea of having skepticism that just because the power is being delegated to a third party, or just because the taking has the form of taking property from one person and giving it to another, that alone doesn't say, there it must be a private use, not a public use. You have to dig deeper and get to the next level of the public use, and I'm happy to talk about that later. I think there are plenty of ways to try to develop a jurisprudence that says, you know, public use has a distinct meaning from public purpose. The classic delegations to private companies to build things that are not just for the public use, but are essentially going to be open to all of the public because the entity that took them is going to operate as a common carrier. The classic example with things like turnpikes and railroads, those kind of situations I think are easy to justify as a public use. I think Justice Thomas would say they're a public use, even though it's a delegation to a private party. So the first point is just those are two very different things. The second thing is conservatives should actually like delegations to private corporations to exercise the eminent domain authority, because the alternative was to just make the state bigger. Like historically, you know, if you put your head back to the 19th century or the late 18th century, there, you know, the federal government had much fewer people in it than it does now. You had a very skinny federal government. And so the idea that, like, every time the federal government might develop some need to, like, build a bridge across to link two states, or a highway or a turnpike, or even, like, you know, the, you know, some of, there's some very interesting old Supreme Court cases about the takings that were involved in creating a canal in Alexandria, or highways in D.C. And in all of those contexts, like, you know, the alternative for the state was, we could make the state bigger, we could run all the highways ourselves, we could run the turnpike or the canal ourselves, or we could delegate it to somebody from private industry who actually knows how to do this thing. And ultimately, I think most of the judgments were made in the early republic are delegated to somebody who knows how to do this thing. The benefit of that is that we don't all of a sudden have, like, you know, a national department of turnpikes and a much bigger government. So again, I just want to try to defang the notion that there's some problem with delegating the eminent domain power. And the third point is, you know, pretty tangential to all of the discussion we've had, but I have to say it because I feel it deeply. So the Penney's case, we won this great 5-4 victory for the pipeline company, which meant that they could clear the hurdle that New Jersey was trying to impose for the building of the pipeline. But what happened, like, 7 months later, 9 months later, they decided they weren't going to build this part of the pipeline through New Jersey because there were, like, 16 other hurdles that they had to clear, including the New Jersey Department of Environment giving them the right permits to do this. And about 3 years ago, I had another case involving where I represented a pipeline, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. And that case presented the fascinating question of whether you could essentially, you know, build a pipeline under the Appalachian Trail, or whether the Appalachian Trail was a barrier to pipeline development, which would be a problem because the Appalachian Trail is over 2,000 miles long. The Fourth Circuit, in its wisdom, though, said, yep, that's a barrier to pipeline development. You can't really do that. And the Supreme Court, 9-0, reversed. And then about 6 months later, the pipeline company abandoned the pipeline through that property. Now, look, I'm happy. They paid my bills in both cases. I'm reasonably happy. But my takeaway from this is there's something fundamentally wrong with the approval process for pipelines. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. If we're going to have pipelines, which, you know, I think we should, but if we're going to have them, it ought to be possible to get the approval process streamlined in a way that you don't present, like, a dozen different potential challenges to opponents of the pipelines. And, you know, and this was promised. I mean, if you go back to the brief in opposition, look at the brief in opposition of the environmental challengers in the Atlantic Coast Pipeline case, they basically told the Supreme Court, don't grant cert in this case, because even if we're wrong about this issue, we have like 10 other things up our sleeves, and we're going to figure out a way to block this pipeline. And it didn't work as a no cert argument, but they sort of had a point. And that just is no way to run a railroad. It's no way to run a pipeline. And so I really do think that is something that is in dire need of reform.
Well, there's so many ways we could go with this. We could hear about why there isn't, you know, more state litigation on this. And we could hear about, if it's so clear from Professor Cooley's treatise and John Lewis's treatise, why was it 5-4? We could hear about, if Justice Thomas has written public use means something more than any conceivable public purpose, what is public use? And where do we draw the line for that? Gentlemen, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm I'm perfectly happy to pick up on where Paul left off, because I think he's exactly right about our pipeline approval process, because the one thing that comes with approval to build a federal natural gas pipeline is the power of eminent domain and not the power to actually build the pipeline. And so the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, armed with the power of eminent domain, did, you know, what it had to do to build the pipeline, and, you know, disrupted countless property owners and took property from countless property owners, only to eventually be told, it turns out the multifarious other government actors in this area won't actually let us build the thing, which seems to me exactly backwards, right? Like, the power of eminent domain should come last in the process. And I analogize this to my work with state and local governments all the time, that if someone came forward and said, we need the power of eminent domain to build this project, but also we don't have zoning approvals, we don't have permits to build, there's no sewage at the site, and there's no road that goes there, that's insane. Like, why would you approve eminent domain for this thing that you don't know you're allowed to build? And that is perversely exactly the system of federal pipeline construction, which I don't know that it has a judicial solution so much as it needs a congressional solution. But it's one of the few areas where I think the condemnors and the condemnees are in perfect agreement that this system is bonkers and needs to change. And I also think he's right that the fact that there's a delegation of the eminent domain power doesn't answer the question of whether the use of eminent domain is constitutional. But I want to stress, I think he's right that it doesn't answer the question. It doesn't tell us that it is constitutional, and it doesn't tell us that it isn't constitutional, particularly if you're concerned that the eminent domain power be used for a public use. And I think Justice Thomas is right that public use encompasses use by the public in the form of a common carrier. We need to be worried about the scope and shape of a delegation. It's one thing to say that this railroad is a common carrier or this pipeline is a common carrier, but it's worth asking the second question of, how do we know it's a common carrier? Who's choosing the route? Who's actually in charge of the exercise of this delegated power? Which is not a question that was presented in the PennEast case, and I don't think reasonably could have been, but is a question in a lot of state-level delegations of power. The way you become a common carrier under Louisiana law to construct a common carrier pipeline is you announce that you are a common carrier pipeline. And there is no regulatory apparatus restricting your ability to grant yourself that power. So I do think the fact that it's a delegation doesn't answer the question telling us that it's unconstitutional, but the fact that it's a delegation does raise second-order questions that we should be asking in these situations, which doesn't mean that the state of New Jersey should have prevailed in PennEast. I'm actually quite glad it didn't, because if pipeline companies can't condemn state-owned land, that just means they're going to condemn more privately owned land, which doesn't seem like it's good for anyone except the state of New Jersey. But I do think that there are further questions in delegation that can and should be developed and are, you know, to mollify Professor Hills, are being developed in state court. We do both. And state courts are an active area of litigation here. I just don't think they're the only area of litigation, because we have a U.S. Constitution for a reason, and I think it should be enforced.
Well, I will respond to Professor Hills, which is more in my subject area. And the rent control issue, I think, is an interesting one. If you look at Cedar Point Nursery and if you look at our brief, it was largely the exact same. The Supreme Court almost adopted verbatim what we had been arguing the entire time, which is very humbling and great, but there was one thing where we differed on, and it was on these exceptions. And we had said that the Supreme Court sort of says a lot of these denials of the right to exclude can be baked into the condition scheme. So you're giving up a government benefit in exchange for a denial of the right to exclude. Where we said, you know, the inspection regimes, the OSHA regimes should fall under background principles, because they're essentially search functions and the government always has the power to search. And we thought that was the better way to look at it. The Supreme Court disagreed and sort of hinted that these would be reviewed under the unconstitutional conditions framework, which is what Professor Hills says is the reason why a lot of these rent control schemes will be upheld. And he might be right about that. And I think the reason why it's wrong to view these as conditions cases is because of what the Supreme Court had held 5 years earlier in Horn. The Chief Justice in Horn says, the government defends Horn, this is the Raisins case in California. The government defends Horn by saying that this is just a condition on your right to enter the raisin market that you have to give up a third of your raisins. This isn't a taking, it's just a condition on using raisins. And the Chief Justice, in a famous opinion, says, the raisins are a healthy snack. You cannot condition your right to enter into agriculture. It's not a pharmaceutical company. And I think that the same logic applies to entering the rental market. There's no government benefit that you're exchanging to enter into the rental market. People have been renting homes and inns since the beginning of time. So to put that into the constitutional conditions framework, I think is misplaced. Whether it's a background principle, I think could be better argued. But where I would agree with Professor Hills is that what we need to, because I do think that the CDC eviction moratorium case and Cedar Point, also Pactel, which was PLS 14th Supreme Court victory last year, all hint that there is this denial of the right to exclude that is paramount, and it does hint at potentially going after eviction or rent control. PLF in 20 years ago had a rent control project that lost 20 cases in a row, and we have a nice long history of precedents upholding rent control, but these three cases, I think, do hint at a potential revival of rent control challenges, and I agree with him that the best way to go about that would be to find a plaintiff, an as-applied challenge to a particular rent control. And in fact, Pactel, which is now on remand to the district court, is along those same lines. Pactel, it's not a complete ban on him inhabiting his property, and we do have other PLF attorneys here who know that case better than I do. But in order to re-inhabit his property, he would have to, or the couple would have to, pay X thousands of dollars in order to get access. So I think these issues are the important ones of the day with regards to Cedar Point Nursery and constitutional conditions, and I guess I just view it a little bit differently than Professor Hills does.
I don't disagree with anything that Josh said. I'll just say that the Supreme Court probably does not want to create a natural right to rent residential real estate. And why is that? Well, because in every one of the 25,000 general jurisdictions that zone, they use their zoning ordinances to exclude the rental of residential real estate in single-family zones, right? And so now what you've got are a bunch of angry homeowners, many of whom are Republicans, with down payments, who say, you just let a hotel move in next door to my, or a bed and breakfast next door to my nice single family home? So you're gonna strike down zoning? And you might say, no, I'm not gonna strike down zoning, that's reasonable. But I am gonna strike down rent control. But all of a sudden, the distinction between zoning and rent control starts to get fuzzy. What about Mitchell Lama? Mitchell Lama gives grants out to people who own residential real estate if they agree to restrict rents. Well, that's a governmental benefit, that grant. Okay, what about 421A tax abatements? Is that a governmental benefit if they cut your taxes? Guess what? You only get a 421A in New York if you agree to put a covenant on the apartment reducing rents. So rent control comes in a zillion shapes and sizes. The court does not want to get involved in that quagmire. It really doesn't matter how often you say, we've got a federal constitution. I guarantee you, federal judges are going to say, I am not going to be the rental guidance board for 25,000 municipalities. And for that reason, I think you got to go state. In all sorts of ways, the state judges, the state constitutions have advantages. Notice, by the way, that if you go the as-applied route, all of a sudden, and I think Paul's and your presentation show this, there's a whole bunch of state backdrops, state law, that obviate the need to decide the federal constitutional question. After all, the pipeline never will be built. Right? Because there's a whole bunch of state statutory rules that might not be met. And so Pullman abstention kicks in. Why should we address this complicated federal constitutional question when we can abstain, send it to state court, and get the whole thing kicked on state grounds? Well, these guys came at 5 a.m. to Cedar Point Nursery without notice, violating the very state law. We're not going to decide this Loretto issue. We're just going to kick it back to state court and say, hey, did they violate state law? So once you get into the business of as-applied plaintiff-specific challenges with the laws actually being enforced against an actual person, the federal courts immediately say, I see a way out of here. I'm going to pull men abstain my way into not having to be the rental guidance board for the United States.
So I'll just sort of, you know, join this conversation with a couple of thoughts. I mean, one is, there's a lot to be said for, you know, litigating in state courts when, you know, it's a good forum. But, you know, if the alternative is try to, you know, get the Supreme Court to do something, you know, kind of modest but important with the takings clause, and the alternative is, like, say, litigating in California state court, you know, I'll take my chances in federal court with that. And then just, you know, just to kind of marry up some of this discussion, I absolutely agree that, you know, as applied is the way to go in these cases. And it's not just because it makes it easier for the court to decide these cases, but it also makes it easier to sort of win the hearts and minds and, you know, have an amicus strategy that can be really successful and to put a, you know, place, a face on these cases. I mean, you know, part of the reason that, you know, people are still talking about Kelo is because, you know, there was a well, you know, selected plaintiff, you know, there was like a house that people could picture. You can make movies about it, you know, and you can't really do that in a facial challenge, you know, especially if the, you know, facial challenge is brought by, you know, kind of a, you know, residential real estate corporation or something. It just doesn't work. The only caveat I would say is, you know, I mean, I agree with you in predicting that these cases will not fare well in the Second Circuit. I think part of the reason for that, though, is just that, you know, people have been challenging New York rent control for, you know, like 50 years, and there's just all these precedents and everywhere you'd want to litigate that are not favorable. And it sounds like, you know, that was sort of your experience with the, you know, the 20 losses in the earlier project. But with all that sort of, you know, kind of partial doom and gloom, I mean, you know, there's another principle of Supreme Court litigation, which is, you know, pigs get fed and hogs get slaughtered. And I do think the current iteration of the New York law is so just cartoonish and absurd. And it's like written by, like, I you know, somebody in this room maybe was like a plant who got into the New York, like, legislature and drafted up the law with, like, the idea that I'm going to make this, like, the perfect test case to get rent control, you know, sort of struck down as a taking. Because it really, it just, it's asking for it. So, I'd offer just that thought because, like, this may be the one facial challenge that could succeed, not because an as-applied challenge wouldn't be much better, but because, wow, this, you know, this law, and just to, you know, say something to Josh, my fellow native Wisconsinite. First of all, how do you like my mask? You know, I'm not wearing it, but yeah, Packer mask. But the second thing I wanted to say is, you know, and that's another reason why Cedar Point, you know, came out the way it did, because you picked both your client exceptionally well, but you picked your target, you know, exceptionally well. And, you know, anytime you pick your target well, unfortunately, it creates this dynamic that, you know, the law that you successfully challenged was so extreme that there's going to be plenty of ways for, in the next case, for people to try to distinguish this because, you know, this isn't 120 days and this isn't, like, you know, all of this thing that's, like, almost, like, tantamount to a permanent physical occupation. But in my experience, it's much more gratifying to try to continue to litigate and deal with people who are distinguishing your win than to lose. So I applaud you for picking, you know, some very, very good targets in that case.
Thank you.
So what are your forecasts for Kelo itself? Is it going to be flat out overruled or incrementally cut away? Or what does anyone have a forecast for Kelo itself? Is there a percolating case? Hopefully not in my circuit, so I don't have some issue. Something like that. And if you don't want to talk about that, do you think the traditional notion of the common good sheds any light on the public use clause? Those are two very different questions, perhaps, and but you can have a shot at either one of them. I mean, and gentlemen in the audience, it would be okay if you line up if you're having questions. We're going to have questions soon from the audience.
I'm happy to take the first one. We don't have anything that's going to come before you, so there's no recusal danger. But I think Kelo is not long for this world. Justice Scalia, before he passed, whenever he was asked in a Q&A what modern Supreme Court case he thought was going to be overturned, he would point to Kelo and say that the backlash to Kelo really demonstrated that the court had gone too far and that the court was going to have to course correct. And I suppose that was easy for him to say because he was in dissent, correctly. But I think he was right. I think the dissent of Eichner shows that there's an appetite to take a case that is rightly framed. We're actively bringing and framing those cases so that we can bring them up. Again, not in the Fifth Circuit yet. But I think the issue is ripe for reconsideration. There really isn't another modern decision that you have being so squarely rejected on its merits, on its own logic, by state high courts that I think it really points up that the modern court has to reconsider at least the sweeping nature of Kelo, even if it doesn't go all the way to adopting Justice Thomas's dissent.
Thank you.
And I'll follow up for what it's worth. But you know, I largely agree. I think it's a close question as to the court doesn't like to overrule its precedents, and Kelo doesn't seem to me to be one that they absolutely have to overrule. In so many words, I mean, I think they can just, because Kelo, the majority opinion, doesn't say that, there's no judicial role in enforcing sort of, public use. And so, this is not one of these ones where they've just sort of said, there's no jurisprudence under this clause, there's no judicial role. And if they'd said that, then it would have to be overruled. But given that even the majority opinion sort of suggests that there is a judicial role, and I think it's a case where the court could make the law a lot better without saying that they're going to overrule Kelo in so many words. It may be cathartic to say it in so many words, so they may do that. And it is a very unpopular decision, so I'm not ruling it out. But I think I almost feel like the harder question is, will they overrule it or just kind of trim back on it? But just to amplify one point that Bob said is I do think that the fact that the state courts have kind of rejected it is particularly important here, because as a general matter, the Supreme Court doesn't care much about what state courts think or do. But this is one area where they think they would, because I think the judicial fear with the public use doctrine is just like, how are we going to come up with kind of an administrable test? And it's much easier to sort of say, the legislature, they're well positioned to figure out what's a public purpose. And, finding out, having a jurisprudence of public use seems like it's hard and might be difficult to administer. And so the fact that the lower courts are not just rejecting the reasoning of Kelo, but kind of stepping up to the plate and saying, no, this is not that hard a judicial role. We can do this under our state constitution, I think is a particularly helpful dynamic in terms of pushing the federal law in the right direction.
I just want to say that if you push the law in the right direction, make sure you don't adopt Kennedy's concurrence. That is a disastrous doctrine. You'll recall that he said, it's not a public use if you condemn some blighted area and then you immediately turn it over to a private person for redevelopment. Now, that is absolute folly. If you're going to condemn a big piece of urban land, you better have a private investor in mind, or else you're going to be like the New London Development Company, which is still holding on to that crappy piece of land, right? So do not condemn land because it's blighted and not have a particular person who's issued an RFP and said they'll take it over. And that's what happens, by the way, when judges get involved in these land use issues, they screw them up because they don't understand real estate finance, they don't understand mortgages, they don't understand security interests, they don't understand how cities do business. And so I really tread with caution if you start having the feds make up a doctrine.
But who also didn't understand those things?
It's New London, Development Corporation.
Well, that's lovely.
We agreed. See?
Sir, did you have a question?
Sure, Chris Green from Ole Miss. I have a question for Paul Clement. Where did you get that gorgeous copy of Cooley's treatise? And if we took it, how much compensation would you?
So, this is why, because it's probably true that if the government came in and said, you're going to make better use out of this than I will.
You would.
Right. So, but that would be wrong somehow. And honestly, they could, give me just compensation measured by what I paid, but that wouldn't make me feel okay. It would still seem like there was a constitutional violation there. I got this the place, you get most things like this. It was either eBay or Abe Books. I think it was probably Abe Books, which I highly recommend as a great place to, and I'm not getting a kickback or anything, but it's a great place to find old law books.
Judge John Curry from Chicago. I'm one of only two judges in the Circuit Court of Cook County that presides over eminent domain cases in our jurisdiction. Actually, Cedar Point came up in a case I decided 2 days ago before I came for this conference. A small suburban municipality needed to repair its sewage lift station, and on the neighboring residential private property, it literally extended its construction footprint over 2,000 square feet of the person's property, put up a construction fence. And the property owner cited Cedar Points to me, and I didn't think he needed to go there. There's a rich, the village contended that, well, we have a right of entry easement. That solves old problems. It says right of easement at all times. Well, we need this construction site at all times, and we're just entering. And there's a rich body of state law across the country. In New York, Litchfield is one case from 1906. In my state, County of Kane, in 1982, both of which are cited all around the country, at least 25 jurisdictions, where it said there's a clear distinction between right of entry and a more dynamic use of the property. And once you cross that line of dynamic use, then condemnation rights are kicked in. It's a kind of taking of a of property, and there has to be a condemnation. I just, you know, like your comments on that and whether that's an alternative to looking at this issue. The second question I would raise, sort of leveraging on the rent control, I had a case, there seems to be now a robust development of anti-gentrification laws in urban areas. In the city of Chicago, the city reclaimed a vacated railroad right away into a lovely parkway. I think there's one in New York City and Manhattan similar to that. And obviously this is a boon to neighborhoods. It is adjacent to what's been for 50 years a low-income Hispanic neighborhood. And the Hispanic alderman there said, we need to preserve our Hispanic neighborhood, and had enacted an anti-gentrification law, which on one hand would require anyone who wanted to tear down a property to build, you know, more expensive single-family residence would have to pay a $15,000 demolition fee per unit on the property. And the second law was if there's more than 50% of the units, 50% of the properties on the block that are multifamily, you cannot tear down your unit to build a new single family residence. I had to dismiss the suit on standing grounds, but I thought there were some intriguing issues raised here on these gentrification, particularly when they have to nibble away through like a demolition fee or a sort of property limitation fee. I'd like your comments on that. And I'll make one last final comment. 3 years ago in this very room, you had a great seminar on eminent domain, and a professor whose name I forgot indicated that on Kelo, basically across the states, has been it's not been a green light to public authorities, but generally there's been a dial back at the state level, state and local level, a lot of statutes that are sort of more on the anti-Kelo end, and common law developing, so it's not as robust as the Kelo decision itself. Thank you, those are my comments.
So we have a testimonial from the state courts. Does anybody want to respond?
Yeah, I'll take the Cedar Point question. Without knowing the intricacies of the case that you adjudicated, I think one thing that happened in the course of litigating Cedar Point is we got a brief, an amicus brief on the other side from a lot of law professors. I hope Professor Hills wasn't on that brief. but it essentially argued that ruling in our favor would upend these centuries-old utility laws and regulations that allowed entries onto private property for regulating utility lines, sewer lines, what have you. But we didn't think so, and the court ultimately agreed because of the background principles exception. If this is something that is inherent in your property right, when you assume that property, now it may be a question of when the background principles, when the clock starts to tick, but with a lot of these utility exceptions, they go back to pre-1776, that the government had the authority to create sewer lines or to maintain sewer lines, not power lines at the time, but essentially our argument was Cedar Point will not upend those sorts of statutes because they aren't infringing on your right to exclude because you never possessed the right to exclude a valid exercise of utility maintenance. So maybe that would apply in the situation that you're talking about. It could also be, if it's just like random torts, that it could be one of those cases that are the dividing line between repeated entries onto private property when that trespass becomes so significant that it becomes the taking of the right to exclude. But either of those exceptions seem to be what I would litigate in a scenario that you're explaining.
I'd like to say a word about inclusionary requirements, because the judge was referring to anti-gentrification requirements. These are typically requirements that if you redevelop land for market rate housing, you have to include affordable units or pay into a housing trust fund or otherwise stop gentrification. And the Supreme Court has recently been giving signs that it might try to put stronger limits on inclusionary zoning. Now, this sounds like a great idea. It's a disaster. And here's why. If you're a libertarian, the thing you care about is restrictive zoning. You got to get rid of restrictive zoning. But getting rid of inclusionary conditions on restrictive zoning doesn't get rid of restrictive zoning. Because if you say to Chicago, oh, you're not allowed to put a condition on 10 extra floor area ratio, FAR as we say in the biz, you know what they're going to do? They're going to say, fine, we just won't give you 10 extra FAR. Now, the next step, of course, you'd say is, oh, well, then the Supreme Court should strike down restrictive zoning, but that's never going to happen. Euclid is 1926, right? It's almost a century old. The country is filled with people who love their zoning on both sides of the aisle. If you think the Supreme Court's going to get rid of, say, single-family zones, you are smoking something. So what does that mean? It means that if you say you can't condition map amendments that rezone on providing rent-controlled units, a whole bunch of left-wing cities are going to say, fine, we won't rezone. And we are facing a housing crisis that's colossal in this country, because cities from San Francisco to New York City to Boston are not rezoning. The housing shortage is absolutely devastating. And the Supreme Court will just pour oil on that fire if it destroys the flexibility of local governments in making conditions. Because the only way you're going to get this stuff through city council, rezoning that allows for apartment buildings and multifamily, is to have those sorts of conditions. Again, just watch out when you make them the zoning board for the United States.
I just want to point out, if you really are a libertarian, you probably are smoking something.
Cigars.
Good one.
Well, wow. I'm sure members of the section are very happy that people are passionate about property rights at this time in the morning. We're into the afternoon now, and you may ask your question, sir.
Wonderful. Hi, Connor Mile from Texas Public Policy Foundation, Center for the American Future. I do energy and environmental law, and I promise I do have a real question, but first of all, Mr. Clement, what is the name of that treatise? I am also very covetous of that book right there.
Constitutional Limitations.
Okay.
It's in the public domain. There's, you know, this is a reprint of the first edition with a nice leather cover. There's lots of different ways to get it. It's really, I mean, you know, Justice Scalia has cited it numerous times in opinions.
Excellent. Thank you. Is for anyone who wants to chime in. On the subject of takings in general, so the elemental question is what properly counts as private property under the takings clause. For instance, a license isn't considered property, despite the fact that a license does convey for a time a set of privileges to use a certain property, or at least it can. Do you think the current view of the scope of private property in federal law entirely comports with the original public meaning of the takings clause? And do you think it's a worthwhile strategy for advocates or academics to argue that instead of expanding what's a taking, the definition of what counts as private property for purposes of a taking should be expanded according to the original public meaning? Or do you think the courts have got it right on that?
Federal or state court?
Either or.
I just have this point about property. As you enlarge the scope of property, so taxi medallions are property, occupational licenses are property, everything becomes property, government becomes mired in gridlock. Example, New York City wants to deregulate the taxi industry by letting Uber and Lyft compete. Guess what argument the owners of taxi medallions make? You can't do that. That's a takings of property without just compensation. So be careful what you wish for. As you multiply property, you make it impossible to deregulate, because every deregulatory impulse can reduce the value of property. Example, on Midtown East, remember Grand Central? Everybody read it the air rights above Grand Central. That was compensation. It was property to get those extra air rights. Well, then New York City Council says, we're going to let everybody have air rights. So the owner of Grand Central Station says, that violates my property rights. You can't deregulate Midtown East and allow everybody to build up, because that means my air rights become worth less money. And so all of a sudden, we're going to lose approximately 6 million square feet of extra building office space and impose a ridiculously restrictive zoning scheme that was designed in 1961 because some libertarian lawyer decided they wanted to make property really broad? Oh, geez. So keep it at the state level. At least we quarantine the harm you can do.
Though if I could quickly stick up for libertarian lawyers. So I think this is, it's less a question of how you define property, more a question of how you define takings. And we litigated a lot of the deregulatory takings cases around Uber and Lyft regulation. And the question there actually is not whether you have a property right in your taxi medallion. I think you clearly do. If New York City wanted to come and take away your taxi medallion you paid money for, that would be a taking. The question is whether it's a taking for the government to act in a way that allows someone else to use their property in a way that prevents money from flowing into your pocket. And that is something that, as a matter of federal law, has never been a taking. The circuits have uniformly recognized that the mere fact that the government is reducing regulations on someone else that might reduce your income doesn't give you a right to storm into court and demand that the government head out and arrest Uber and Lyft drivers, which was actually in Chicago was the claim initially brought by the taxi drivers. They wanted an injunction forcing the police to arrest people who were driving for Lyft. And so we represented Lyft drivers who would, you know, prefer not to be arrested. So I think it's less whether we define that as property and whether we define property as a right to avoid any diminution in value. And I think that's really the fulcrum of those cases, not so much that we libertarians have gotten out over our skis in defining what property is or isn't.
Our cigar-smoking gentleman.
Isaiah McKinney, 3L Wake Forest. I've also had the pleasure of bothering Josh as a summer clerk at PLF. I wanted to ask about the 11th Amendment and property. So I heard Professor Merrill make an argument recently that after Penn East, where the court said the state can't use the 11th Amendment to protect sovereign, it can be sued for taking its own property. Couldn't there also be, Professor Merrill's point was that you can make an argument now that when private property owners have had their property taken from state, but at state level, by the state, and are suing the state to get just compensation, in similar like a Nick case, that the state shouldn't be able to plead the 11th Amendment to protect themselves against that claimant for just compensation. What would be your response to that? Are we seeing the sovereign immunity in the 11th Amendment being eroded in Fifth Amendment taking claims?
So, I mean, I'll take that, and I'll also sort of belatedly answer, the judge's question about why, if it's so clear that delegation of the eminent domain power is, not that bad a thing, why was Penn East 5-4? I mean, it was 5-4 because of the 11th Amendment issue, because of the federalism issues. I actually don't think the dissenters, read those opinions like in light of Justice Thomas's dissent in Kelo. I don't think the dissenters had a problem with the bare fact that there was a delegation of the eminent domain power there. And it was the combination of the eminent domain power and then suing a state as a defendant. So I don't think there is going to be any erosion of the sort of state's ability to, I don't think you can bring like an eminent domain action that would otherwise be an entitlement under state law in federal court now or anything like that. I mean, and I think, the key to the Penn East case is the idea that what you really have is an understanding that even when you delegate the eminent domain authority, the delegee is, effectively still a federal actor, is the way I think about it. And so, and that sort of has to make sense, right? Because the Constitution generally only applies to state actors in the 14th Amendment, federal actors in the context of the, unamended Constitution. And so, if there's a private entity exercising properly delegated eminent domain authority, and they don't give you just compensation, well, you can sue them under the takings clause, and they're violating the takings clause. So you know, I think you have to kind of understand that if the delegation is valid and it's a delegation from the federal government, then they're exercising a federal power. And then I think the holding of Penn East, which kind of builds on United States against Texas, is the idea that when, you know, a federal agent is suing a state government, the state doesn't get to assert the 11th Amendment in response because they sort of surrendered that in the plan of the convention. And so I don't really think that logic, you know, the court could have decided it some other way and said, you know, eminent domain proceedings are sui generis, such that the 11th Amendment doesn't apply. And if they decided it that way, I think there would be more to the argument that maybe that has legs and other implications. But I think given the way that the court actually decided it, I don't see that it really extends to anybody who's not a federal delegee and could be understood as a federal actor.
I have a question for Mr. Thompson, perhaps reflecting a bit of Professor Hills's pessimism, so apologies in advance for that. But in reading Cedar Point, it seemed that an extolling a right to exclude, the Supreme Court implicitly sort of denigrated a right to include in the bundle of rights. Maybe my reading is wrong on that, but they seem to suggest that would be, you know, resolved under Penn Central. And so the category of regulation I have in mind in particular are the very common local restrictions or even prohibitions on the ability of people to use their own residences for short-term rentals, for example, through Airbnb or VRBO. Do you see a route via which the Supreme Court might actually expand the right to include people in your own property, or is my pessimism there well-founded? Thank you.
Sure. The Supreme Court certainly holds a special solicitude for the right to exclude, and that doctrine goes back for hundreds of years. I think the analogy of the bundle of sticks is what really harms other challenges to property right regulation. The bundle of sticks implies that you can take away, you know, your right to build a chicken coop or to paint your house blue or to rent to Airbnb folks, and that still keeps your bundle of sticks essentially there. And I think that's the only constitutional right that we've sort of framed that way. You could frame the First Amendment or the Second Amendment that way as well, but only property rights has this bundle of sticks analogy that gets thrown at it all the time. I think, notwithstanding my objection to the bundle of sticks analogy, it is pretty prevalent in the case law, and only the right to exclude to this day has been singled out as deserving of special treatment. Essentially what the court said, I think, in Cedar Point is that without the right to exclude, private property is no longer private. It's the sort of the fundamental stick that cannot be taken away without just compensation. So I would like to see more sticks eligible for the per se treatment. I would encourage us to try to think of property rights in a different framework than the bundle of sticks going forward and not use that as litigators. But I don't see a immediate path victory under the Fifth Amendment to challenging some of these local restrictions on bed and breakfast. Now, there are challenges. I think IJ is doing some of them. Under the Fourth Amendment, there may be an economic liberty challenge to some of these. There are inspection regimes that can be challenged. But as it stands now, I don't think the Fifth Amendment is a likely path to victory, unfortunately.
You have the distinction of asking the last question, but you need to make it snappy.
Thank you. I originally got up at Gideon Rappaport, NYU Law. I got up originally to push on the point of property rights being expanded and somehow everything the government letting somebody do something is now a taking of other people's right is now worth less. But my question is, pushing back on Professor Hill's idea that this is a quagmire, this is too complicated for courts to do. Courts all the time, it's like the World Trade Organization, International Trade Court, they always deal with issues of differentiating real health and safety restrictions from essentially protectionism. That's much harder than this. You can get the economists involved and you can see that by a certain level of rent control, rather than splitting the surplus, you're essentially pushing a product below the weighted average cost of capital of the investor, and then essentially you are taking their property by forcing to rent for less than the return they would be owed. I don't think it's that fact intensive, and if anything, courts can use a bit of interim to stop these extreme rent control. I would hope in general, all of it. But this is possible to do in a manner that is just limiting the profit of the landlords to a certain extent, as opposed to pushing them into the red, which is what happened to a lot of people in New York in particular.
Anyone want to respond? Courts doing economics.
I think it's great that courts do it, just not through the Constitution. The U.S. Constitution is unamendable virtually, and it's controlled by 9 lawyers. So it's highly centralized and very difficult to modify, unlike the WTO, which is controlled by democratically accountable governments, or unlike common law nuisance, which is controlled by judges, often elected and amendable by state legislatures. So I think it's wonderful to have cost-benefit analysis and nuanced, fact-specific regulation. Just don't assign that job to a single agency, the U.S. Supreme Court, and make it immune from control by every other entity in the business. Look, you guys in the Federalist Society were founded to limit the power of the U.S. Supreme Court, right? So by all means, do this stuff. Just choose the forum wisely in which it is done.
And can I just offer one sort of slight counterpoint to that? I guess, you know, I would take what Professor Hills is saying very seriously, but my recommendation would be to take it not as gospel, but as a challenge. Because, you know, I could be upstairs talking about the Second Amendment, and in that context, you know, you sort of hear some of the same kind of idea that, like, oh, gee whiz, if the court gets involved in this, you know, they're gonna have to look at all these different laws, and they're gonna have to develop a whole jurisprudence. And I would say, A, that's what the court's supposed to do when there's on-point constitutional text, which there is in the Second Amendment and there is in the Fifth Amendment, and not in a lot of other areas the court's involved. So that's their job, but it's our job as litigators to make that administrable and to avoid some of the nightmares. So like I said, don't take it as like, you know, stop suing in federal court entirely, go to state court. That may be what you mean, but what I would take it as is take it as a challenge. You know, it doesn't have to be a land war in Asia. You know, there probably was a better way to withdraw troops from Afghanistan too. Like, so take it as a challenge, but don't take it lightly, because what he's saying is what a lot of judges are thinking, particularly if you're trying to take them to some place that they haven't been before, or worse yet, a place that they were once before and sort of retreated. So you do really have to, the challenge is on you is, you know, what's your limiting principle? How are you gonna win this case in a way that's actually administrable and doesn't create problems? Give that a lot of thought on the front end. And then, you know, it doesn't end up being a quagmire.
Ladies and gentlemen, our time has come to an end. Please join us for the annual Rosencrantz debate and luncheon in the Grand Ballroom at 12:30. And before you go, please give a warm hand of appreciation to our esteemed panel.